and good morning. My name is Rob Daniels, and welcome to Visions in Sound. For those that may not know me, Visions in Sound is a movie, TV, and video game soundtrack program that I produce each and every week here on CKWR. Now, Hollywood and religion have been strange bedfellows since the dawn of film, but when you think about it, there are religious references in films all the time, and often you aren't quite aware of it. I keep thinking of the Matrix and, more recently, Tron Legacy, where there is pseudo-religious content wrapped in a sci-fi story. Well, today's show, though, will be dealing with stories that deal directly with the man himself, Jesus. Now, I recently became a member of Bethel Lutheran Church and have discovered that a lot of what I knew, or rather what I thought I knew about religion, did in fact come from the movies. Well, now also joining me on this week's program is Pastor Joe Das from Bethel Evangelical Lutheran Church. It's a pleasure to have you here on the show, Joe. So, Pastor Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Hey, not a problem.
I enjoy being a pastor at Bethel Lutheran Church, which I joined not even quite 2 years ago. I wasn't always a pastor. Before I was a pastor, I was an engineering, electrical engineering in particular, and got into various branches involved in that. After that, when I was working, then I would have some volunteer activities that I got involved in, including several years with an outfit that used to produce Christian-oriented rock musicals, and rock musicals intended to stimulate religious debate during the 90s. And then At that time, I met my wife, Sylvia Kirchmar, who some of you might know. She has a career in broadcasting over 20 years from the 80s through the early 2000s. And it was at that time that I had the call to go into the ministry. And over a route like that, I wound up eventually at Bethel Lutheran Church.
Awesome. Well, now we're going to be discussing some of the movies that deal with the life of Jesus. Now, movies about biblical characters are really nothing new. I keep thinking about Charlton Heston in The Ten Commandments, for just one example. But we're going to focus on four of the Hollywood films that deal with the story of Jesus: The Greatest Story Ever Told, Jesus Christ Superstar, The Gospel of John, and The Passion of the Christ. Now, there's one thing that's always kind of stuck in my mind. Why do they call it The Passion? I mean, I have a definition of passion in my mind, but why do they call it the passion of the? Why do they call it a passion?
Well, the passion is actually a theological term to describe the circumstances surrounding Jesus' suffering, crucifixion, and death during the last roughly 24 hours of his life. We're dealing with a situation described in some considerable detail in the New Testament documents in particular. When people read them, they discover that much more attention and much more focus is placed on them than on even much of his ministry. Like, several chapters in each of the New Testament books cover what happened to him on that Thursday, Friday, and Sunday.
Okay. Now, I find it interesting with more recent movies like The Last Temptation of Christ and, you know, The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's film. Why do you think that filmmakers return to the story of Christ, even though there is controversy involved in the films?
That is a fascinating question to look into, because this has been an issue. The interface between art and religion is one that is incredibly important to cultures in general all over the world, and our culture is no exception. The history of our culture is that it's rooted in the culture of the Old Testament, the Hebrew culture, and the Greco-Roman culture, which we know from the classics, i.e. Plato, the people that ran the Greek democracies and the Roman Republic and later Empire. And these things meshed and formed a culture which might almost be called a Christian culture, though they don't exactly overlap. And yet, everything that we have in our culture influences us in this direction, whether we know it or not, whether we accept it or not. A lot of the language we have, for example, is out of the Bible. King James has influenced even the way we talk.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time when the only Bible that I would read would have these and thous in it, but now I'm getting into the more modernistic Bible and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's kind of interesting how that works. Now, for those that may not know, I mean, I'm still not 100% sure of the significance of I hadn't heard of Maundy Thursday until I joined Bethel Lutheran Church. So what is the significance of Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Easter Sunday, and then finally Easter Monday?
Good question about Maundy Thursday is that I used to get that question myself from other members, and I had remembered asking that as a layman years ago. It comes from the Latin mandatum, and it's because it's the day that Jesus gave instructions to his disciples to celebrate what we now call the Lord's Supper, and where he specifically asked them or told them to do this in perpetuity in remembrance of him. In our case, we remember in our church, as we even did the last couple of days, of participating in what might be called kind of a sacramental reenactment of the Lord's Supper in memory of what he did, receiving his body and blood, as it says in the words of the New Testament. On Good Friday, we celebrate a Friday that people find it strange to call good because of the terrible things that took place on that day for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been terrible for him, but according to the Christian report of what the meaning of this was, it was a good day for us because it was the day that God made peace with the human race on account of all of the sin that had corrupted the human race and had to be paid for individually up until that time. The sacrifice that Jesus made is referred to Jesus being the Lamb of God. And that's a reference to the Passover, which leads us into Easter.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Jesus died on the Friday is because the Saturday of that week was the high festival of the Jewish calendar, and okay, they did not want to leave his body on the cross until then. So they really had to rush if they wanted to put him to death. On Sunday, Easter Sunday, which is the highest festival in the Christian year, we celebrate the report of Jesus rising from the dead and having been seen by his disciples on various occasions, which were rather unlikely. And so he appeared for 40 days after that and ascended into heaven on ascension.
Okay. So now, first up on the show, we have a score from a 1965 film, The Greatest Story Ever Told, which has a huge cast list. Just a few: Angela Lansbury, Martin Landau, Pat Boone, Charlton Heston plays John the Baptist, and Max von Sydow plays Jesus. Now, this George Stevens production that leads us toward the climactic crossroads that the story of Jesus of Nazareth takes. It takes us to the final moment, and it again looks back in triumphant retrospect at the eternal questions of faith and doubt, and they become resolved. Now, the score for this film was done by the late, great Alfred Newman, and the soundtrack has seen many releases, but the music that we're going to hear tonight is from a 3-disc set from the Ryko Disc Company and is still available. Now, I have not seen this film recently. It's been a while since I've actually seen the film itself. So could you, have you actually seen the film recently?
I have, but it's been a while. I do remember the show in some of the general broad strokes of how Jesus was portrayed and the people around him. And at the time, it was kind of in keeping with the traditions of producing religious themes, in like biblical themes in Hollywood. There is a particular kind of otherworldliness to the characters. They appear almost like some kind of what we might stereotypically call mystical persons. And you'll notice if you watch the development of these movies in Hollywood over time that there is a transformation, and that from the way the characters were depicted then compared to the way the characters are depicted now is that they're much more this-worldly and much more immediate and three-dimensional than they used to be. And perhaps that is because people are expecting more from this type of media than they used to. Hollywood, after World War II, being, of course, a means of escape and entertainment, has still become more immersive in the material they produce now.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we just kind of discussed off air was the change of music.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of get into that whole change of music when we go from, let's say, this particular movie to like The Gospel of John and The Passion of the Christ. There's a definite shift in the way this music sounds. Now, let's have a listen to Alfred Newman's score to the greatest story ever told, and we'll be back in just a little bit. But before I do go, if you are interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on the show, you can contact me at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. You can also also be on Facebook this evening. You can try my Facebook fan page, facebook.com/visionsinsound, or you can also try just looking up my name, Robert Daniels. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and I'm sure Joe will be able to answer any questions that you have as well. So here is some of Alfred Newman's music from the 1965 film The Greatest Story Ever Told. Back in a bit.
Thank you.
with just a little bit of music from the 1965 film. That's music by The Greatest Story Ever Told, music by Alfred Newman. Well, welcome back to Visions and Sound as we talk about He Has Risen. Now, one of the things, and also joining me this week is Pastor Joe Das, from the Bethel Evangelical Lutheran Church. One of the things, Joe, that I've noticed in the past few years that I've been in part of the church, that when you say He has risen, then the congregation replies, He has risen indeed. So where does that come from, and why is that done?
Great question. It's an ancient greeting, and it kind of has almost a liturgical practice to it. That means that it comes out of things that are said in a church service for Easter. But it was also a greeting that was used by the Christians in general in ancient times. And it's rooted in the idea that the disciples were quite struck or almost dumbfounded by the whole experience of Jesus having fulfilled what he said would happen, was that he would rise from the dead on the third day. And so everything got started. There was a new stage after the disciples had been hiding for fear of persecution and had felt as if everything was lost, until news arrived that Jesus was alive and that he had been seen. And so they would share this news, and Jesus would appear, and they would remind each other and tell each other about Jesus now being alive. And actually, that is a key to Christianity in general. And it's important that Christians remind themselves of that, because that's where the power comes from.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Well, if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions in Sound, by all means, you can contact me at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. You can also visit facebook.com/visionsinsound. That's my Visions in Sound fan page. You can also look for me online, Robert Daniels, and also visit the Bethel website at bethelkitchener.ca. And you'll find out about the church and all that's going on there. Well, now, welcome back to Visions and Sound. As this week we look at scores and music from films about the life of Christ on this Easter weekend. Now, this next one, I think both Joe and I are kind of excited about, because it's kind of an unusual take on the whole story of the life of Christ. Now, up next on today's program is the songs from the 1973 film Jesus Christ Superstar. Now, this Norman Jewison film, who's Canadian, by the way, is based on a concept album project written by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice that spawned the long-running Broadway performance. Now, the film tells the story of the final 6 days in the life of Jesus Christ through the troubled eyes of Judas Iscariot. This film is often mislabeled as a musical, but is best known as a rock opera. There are no spoken lines. Everything is sung. And now, the film is unique in its approach, as it incorporates some modern-day images in the biblical setting. You know, you see tanks, and you see, you know, other like grenades in the market and that sort of thing. So in this case, Ted Neely is Jesus, and he would play Jesus for many years after this on the stage as well. Now, the music and songs were, of course, done by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, with a little help from composer Andre Previn, which I found out earlier as well. He also added some additional music as well. Now, the album was released on the MCA label and was re-released recently in a 25th anniversary edition. So this film, Jesus Christ Superstar, we go from one extreme to another. We go from the very traditional Greatest Story Ever Told to this rock opera done in the 70s. And we kind of discussed the whole passing daisies around that kind of thing. So I've seen Jesus Christ Superstar recently, and it is that kind of the era it comes from is definitely prevalent in the film itself. So what do you think of Jesus Christ Superstar?
I remember us talking about it, and I haven't seen it recently, but the funny part is that growing up, I remember seeing the movie at a rather young age. I think I was younger than I was supposed to be watching the movie. it left quite an impression on me, and having listened to some of the music again, I found that it was quite it gave me pause for thought to listen to how the music was really rooted in the era that it was written in, but at the same time also where a new emotional dimension was put into place, where the characters suddenly seemed to be characters that could have been brought in from anywhere from the early 1970s, mm-hmm. and these would be people that you could actually imagine meeting yourself. There is merit to that, and I think that when you juxtapose these two different, very different approaches to composing music about the life of Jesus, mm-hmm. you can get a bit more of a flavor of the real dimensions of what the New Testament is getting at.
Right. Well, now what we're going to do is we're going to go right to it because this is some really interesting music. We'll just get right to it. This is music from Jesus Christ Superstar, the Norman Jewison film from 1973.
Thank you. My mind is clearer now. At last, all too well, I can see where we all soon will be. If you strip away the myth from the man, you will see where we all soon will be. Jesus, you've started to believe the things they say of you. You really do believe this talk of God is true. And all the good you've done will soon get swept away. You've begun to matter more than the things you say. Listen, Jesus, I don't like what I see. All I ask is that you listen to me. And remember, I've been your right-hand man all along. You have set them all on fire. They think they found the new Messiah. And they'll hurt you when they find they're wrong. I remember when this whole thing began. No talk of God, then we called you a man. And believe me, my admiration for you hasn't died. But every word you say today gets twisted round some other way. And they'll hurt you if they think you've lied. Nazareth, your famous son, should have stayed a great unknown. Like his father, carving wood, he'd have made good. Tables, chairs, and oaken chests would have suited Jesus best. He'd have caused nobody harm, no one alarm. Listen, Jesus, do you care for your race? Don't you see we must keep in our place? We are occupied. Have you forgotten how put down we are? I am frightened by the crowd, for we are getting much too loud. And they'll crush us if we go too far. If we go too far. Listen, Jesus, to the warning I give. Please remember that I want us to live. But it's sad to see our chances weakening with every year. Your followers are blind, too much heaven on their minds. It was beautiful, but now it's sour. Yes, it's all to the warning I give. Please remember that I want us to live. So come on, come on. He won't listen to me. Come on, listen. Listen to me. Come on and listen to me. See why he moved.
Should I bring him down? Should I scream and shout? Should I speak of love? Let my feelings out. I never thought I'd come to this. What's it all about? Don't you think it's I should be in this position? I'm the one who's always been so calm, so cool. No lover's fool running every show. He scares me so.
Was he where it's at? Is he where you are? Good morning. was that just the odds? To me, silence, that was not a mistake. Oh, did you know your message that would be a record breaker? Don't get me wrong. 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 I don't want to know. I don't want to know. I don't want to know. I only want to know.
Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Who are you? What have you sacrificed? Jesus Christ.
And with just a little bit of music from the 1973 film Jesus Christ Superstar. Wow, that's quite a different kind of approach to this, to the story of Jesus. But then there's that last piece, which is actually called John 1941, that really is different from the whole all of the other pieces that have gone kind of been kind of this really kind of poppy rock opera kind of stuff. So yeah, it's really jarring when you hear that. But what is the significance of John 19:41, and what is the verse?
It says, "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid." This is from ESV, one of the recent Bible translations.
Okay,
and it is interesting that Andrew Lloyd Webber and his team decided to emphasize this particular aspect, the burial of Christ, with the music that was very different. there's the scene with the shepherd and a flock of sheep going by where the cross is. Mm-hmm. And that would be a reference to Jesus saying, I am the good shepherd, and lay down my life for the sheep.
Right.
So it's poignant that that this very serious and very blessed message would somehow still be in there, even in the midst of what some Christians would have viewed as horrifying in the way the era is depicted with Jesus in there, with all of the vices that we think of during that time, mm-hmm. you know, the looseness of morals, the free love, and the whole drug culture, and all of these things you see in most of the movie, or in a lot of the movie, you have this sense of that being there.
Yeah, it's just kind of just under the surface.
Right, right. But on the other hand, when you have this scene, which is suddenly so peaceful, it harkens back to the otherworldliness of the other movies that depict the life of Jesus from earlier times.
Exactly.
In fact, it's interesting to note that in the history of filmmaking, numerous films have been about Jesus, even going back as far as 1895.
Mm-hmm.
So it is true, the filmmaking community has taken this account very, very seriously, but they have to, because it's so central to who we are in this culture.
Exactly. Well, thanks for filling that in, because I hate to admit that I'm not familiar with John 1941, so that's nice. I'm glad that you're able to do that. So welcome back to Visions and Sound, as this week we're looking at the songs and scores from the movies about Jesus on this Easter weekend. Now, up next on the show is kind of an unusual film in its obscurity, but I'll get to that in just a second. We look at this 2003 movie called The Gospel of John. Now, in this film, the story of Jesus' life is told by the Apostle John and is narrated by Christopher Plummer. Now, although this movie was released almost a year prior, before The Passion of the Christ, it is almost vanished from view as a viable Christian movie. Now, Jesus in this case is played by Henry Ian Cusick, and Canadian composer Jeff Dana was tapped to score this film, and the score was released on the Verez Saraband label. The Dana brothers are no strangers to religious epics either. As Michael Dana, Jeff's brother, also scored the Nativity Story, a recent film as well. So this is a film that I have not seen, and it's too bad, because it's one of those films that I honestly would think that it came out around that time that. There was buzz about Passion of the Christ, and it just didn't show up. So it's unfortunate that is the case. Joe, you haven't seen this film either, have you?
I'm not sure I have. It is true that Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ overshadowed it, mm-hmm. in a way, but I do remember that. Actually, I do recall I probably have seen a few scenes of it.
Okay.
Because the depiction of Jesus, again, is different from the depiction of Jesus in earlier movies. He's very accessible. He's very kind and friendly and a bit more fun-loving.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Bible scholars have recently been drawing more attention to is that Jesus was really engaging conversationally.
Right.
And that has gotten lost in the bombast that we like to assign to whenever Jesus speaks, because mm-hmm. because he does speak into the world, being, you know, the only begotten Son of God and all that, as we confess, but there is the human side, and the human side is much richer and much more three-dimensional than most of us care to realize or admit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that aspect comes out a little bit more in this film, and I remember people laughing at things that Jesus would say, because he would use humor to bring points across.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah.
I was just going to say, that's one thing that has always surprised me. In any of the portrayals of Jesus I've seen, he's very stoic, very very serious, and you don't think of Jesus as using humor as a way of kind of bringing people into it. So it's kind of nice to see that.
Yeah, very much so, because, you know, there is this point where there is a faction that accused Jesus of being a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. And clearly he enjoyed people's company and got together with them and was one of the guys when it was time for that.
Mm-hmm.
And he could do so without sinning. And I think that because of some of our what we call Puritan, which isn't really fair to the Puritans, what we call this environment, this attitude where we dislike the enjoyment of life with other people, that is sometimes preached in a very legalistic way, which is really misguided.
Mm-hmm.
It takes away from Jesus's humanity as well, because we can watch him and see him enjoy being with people, and so that's also something for Christians of our time to remember.
All right. Well, now this is kind of harkens back to what we discussed earlier about the more traditional sound that Alfred Newman had. Now this gets into the more kind of what would have been around at the time, the musical instruments and that kind of stuff. So this is this shift from this more traditional scoring for films to a more realistic sound to what may have been, you know, played back then and those kind of instruments and that sort of thing. So you're going to see a definite difference in this score. So this is Jeff Dana's score to The Gospel of John, and we'll be back in just a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you.
and with a much more, more authentic sound. That's Jeff Dana's score to the Gospel of John. Fantastic score. I now really want to see the movie, and so I'll get it, when I get a chance to see it. I think it'll be really great. Anyway, welcome back to Visions in Sound. As this week we look at the movies about the life of Christ on this Easter weekend. Now, last up we're looking at the score to the Mel Gibson directed film The Passion of the Christ. However, before we get to the score, I have an interview that recorded with John Debney in 2004. And the composer of this film, and he talks about some of his very interesting experiences working on this film, as well as just some other little background information. So here is some of that interview, and we'll be back in just a little bit.
Well, for a long time before the Passion of the Christ actually had a composer attached to it, there were a lot of other names attached to it.
Correct.
How did you first become aware of the Passion of the Christ?
Well, I got a phone call, interestingly enough, last October, from a lifelong friend of mine, actually, that happened to be the producer on the movie. I hadn't spoken with this gentleman for a few years. We had just lost touch, but nonetheless, we had grown up on the same street, and we were truly lifelong buddies because I grew up with him. He called me in October and was very cryptic. He said, "Look, you know, how are you?" And I said, "Great." And my first thought was, "Oh, my gosh, I hope his family is okay," because, you know, I hadn't heard from him in a while. All of a sudden, get a phone call, and his family was okay, and he started to proceed to talk to me about a project they were doing that was, they were in a quandary about. They just curious what I was doing and what my life was like. Anyway, he finally kind of revealed what the project was, and I fell off my chair because I'm a lifelong Catholic that had lost the faith for a while there, but a couple of years ago it started to regain it, mm-hmm. had a sort of spiritual reawakening in the last couple of years, and he started telling me about the project, and one of their quandaries with the music was Mel was not sure if he wanted sort of a traditional score, if he wanted to just have all music from the period and the time and have that be the score. Mm-hmm. So through a conversation that we had on the phone, obviously they were having some trouble, and there was a gentleman on the movie that had done some wonderful sort of field recordings and had written a couple of nice pieces that they liked, but they really felt, I think, that they were in need of a film scorer, a film composer, someone like myself that had done a lot of that, and that, again, was able to make those shifts that, you know, one can only sort of get through doing it a lot and learning the process, learning the skill of writing for a film. I surmise. So I offered to, take the weekend. It was probably on a Thursday. I said, "Steve, if I could have the weekend to write a couple pieces of music, do you think Mel would listen to them?" He said, "Oh, well, God, if you're offering to do that, sure, that would be amazing." And he said, "Let me talk to Mel and see if he'll come over and listen to whatever you're going to do." So it's exactly what happened. I wrote all weekend. I wrote a theme for the trailer of the film, because mm-hmm. they didn't have music for the trailer yet. Mel came over, he heard a few pieces I'd written and sort of liked the direction and went away, and then a few hours later I got a phone call saying, "Look, Mel thinks he wants to do this with you." So that's how it happened. It was a complete fluke, in my opinion, and it literally fell in my lap. I didn't lobby for it. I was not the first logical choice, you might imagine, looking at my credits. I tell people it was literally from above that this thing landed in my lap, because I'm known as the comedy guy. So mm-hmm. having the honor of being asked to be a part of this was completely mind-blowing to me. Okay. But that's how it happened.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the fact that you've been known as the comedy guy. Now, is it hard to change hats? I mean, you went from a comedy like Elf or Bruce Almighty to composing this very serious Passion of the Christ story.
It was very hard. That's a good question. This score was not an easy one to realize. And yet, you know, the images are so beautiful and powerful and emotional that, you know, in one sense, and I told Mel this, it's so funny, I said to Mel numerous times, I said, no, you know, I said, Mel, it doesn't really matter what music you put against this movie. I said, for that matter, you don't even need any music in this movie. And he said, no, I appreciate that, but no, I want the music to be there. And then we would have that discussion. But the truth is, in my humble opinion, that the movie is so incredible, and what Mel has done is so incredible that, you know, I could have literally held a note, one note, and it would have meant a lot, probably, because the nature of the movie is such. But having said that, I also knew that whatever I was going to do, it had to be pretty, you know, it certainly had to be the best that I could humanly do. And that's what I just stuck with, was what is the very best that I can offer. And that's what I did. So that in one sense, it wasn't that difficult for me to write music to the film. The difficulty was in finding the right music to put to the film. I put it that way.
Right. So did your approach to The Passion of the Christ differ from any other films that you differ from any other films that you've done recently?
Well, I think that the film itself is completely unique, and I think if you were talking to anyone involved with the movie, from the cinematographer to the sound effects guys, we all have the same feeling about it, and that is that we probably won't ever get the opportunity to work on something like this again. God willing, we will, but we all feel that this is sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for us, no matter what our faith. In that sense, I really didn't write any differently than actually, my experience sort of got me through in a lot of ways, because you can imagine I had to divorce myself sometimes from the images. And otherwise, I would be a weepy mess every day, you know. And so I did that. And I would sort of detach myself a bit, which is what I do. I have to detach myself sometimes from what I'm looking at and realize that there's a skill to what I do, and there's a technique to what I do, and I sort of let that take over sometimes. And so I didn't approach it differently from that aspect. Mm-hmm. The technique is the same, whatever genre I'm working in. It's usually me sitting down and forcing myself to play a note and then play another note. And then, you know, and that's, honestly, it sounds simple, but that is the process. It's like somebody asked me about writer's block. It was a screenwriter I was speaking to, and they said, how do you deal with writer's block? And I said, you know, I sort of learned a long time ago the best way to do this, and I think it's true with writing a novel as it is with writing a piece of music, that I just sit down and I play the one note, or maybe a writer would put the first word on the page and then put the next word. And in that way, I think it forces you subconsciously maybe to just realize it's just, you know, put it down, and it may be good or bad, but at least you're opening up the floodgate, as it were. So that's what I do, you know?
Okay. So during the composition of the composing process of the Passion of the Christ, was there any point, like you deal, obviously dealing a lot with music, was there any point where you said, this scene would probably work better with nothing at all?
Good question. Mel and I would agonize over that. Sometimes I would start a piece of music a little early, you know, and I would try it out. And I will tell you, 10 times out of 10, I found that he was usually right. I might try to play a scene in a certain way, maybe, you know, and I remember in a couple cases I might have started the music a little earlier than he would have. And maybe my emotional take on it, I would have the music be a little more emotional in content that Mel would like. And what I discovered is that he was completely correct with this film, in that he said to me, John, he goes, you know, I never want the music to be too reverential or too, he says, I don't want any God music here. But he said, there will be those points when we can do that. And he was absolutely right, so that when you experience the film, The moments when the music swells or gets a little more emotional or gets bigger, those are very carefully chosen moments, and really carefully chosen by Mel. And I completely learned that he was right in the process, that the moments have to be earned, as he said, and he was right. So that when, I think when the audience experiences the movie and hears the music, when those moments occur, they seem to make it more powerful. If I had started writing the music and every piece of music was, you know, you'd hear the strings and the choir, and that would have been wrong. You'd start to tune that out, and it wouldn't be real. So it was very carefully chosen and orchestrated, as it were, to, you know, when that moment was right, we took advantage of it, as it were. And I think that the audience needs to be able to release at that point, as it were. I think the music hopefully will help them get through some tough moments in the film, and you know, that'll make it easier for us all to deal with the hard part of the film, and that is ultimately uplifting in the end.
Right. Now, according to reports, the actor Jim Caviezel was actually struck by lightning on the set.
I believe that's right. I've heard that.
Yeah. Were there any unusual happenings while you were composing or recording the score of?
Rob, we don't have enough time. I'll put it this way. Where to begin? Every day was a struggle for me because imagine I'm in this very nice studio that I'm very fortunate to have, mm-hmm. and I've got all these amazing computers and synthesizers and electronic equipment surrounding me, and I boot up the computer and I make my music. Well, on this particular film, it hasn't happened on any others, and I'm working on another film right now, and it hasn't happened since I finished working on The Passion. Well, the computers would decide to crash 10 to 15 times a day.
Oh.
And they would crash at very interesting moments, usually on a shot of Satan, or on an incredibly poignant shot of Jesus. And it's very odd because I discovered, after the first few weeks working on the movie, that I was having my personal battle with my own demons, but also, you know, if you're a believer, the guy downstairs. Mm-hmm. So I realized that early on. And by the way, I think everyone on the film will tell you this, that we all had our struggles with just technical struggles, with things not working and bizarre occurrences and power going out in my studio, and it didn't go out anywhere else on the block. So one by one, my music team, the guys that I work with daily, you know, some of them are not as perhaps spiritual as me, but nonetheless, they're great people, and you know, I would tell them these things, and they would kind of laugh at me. Okay, yeah, sure, John, yeah, yeah. Well, one by one, they'd come to me, like I'd see one or the other the next morning, they'd go, you'll never guess what happened last night. I would laugh, because I was tested, we were tested so powerfully. And again, I think if you talk to anyone on the movie, they would tell you the same thing, including Jim Caviezel, I believe. Mm-hmm. Getting hit by lightning. My studio not working half the time. You know, just odd things that made me realize that it wasn't coincidence. That I just think there were a lot of things that were conspiring against any of us making it through this. This movie, I tell people, it took a year off my life. Mm-hmm. It was both the most incredibly physically and emotionally exhausting, but it was ultimately the most uplifting, too. Because mm-hmm. when we finally made it to London and we're sitting there with an orchestra and we're recording in this converted church, it's a place called Air Lyndhurst, and the stained glass windows are still there, and the sun is coming through, and every moment of the music, the light is changing. It made it all worthwhile. And Mel was there, and we just had this amazing experience. But it was not easy. And I'm sure you'll start with, you know, you start with Jim Caviezel at the, playing the lead. You know, I mean, what more do you have to go through? On top of everything else, he gets hit by lightning.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other many other miracles, and I will call them miracles, not that occurred with me necessarily, but that occurred that were related to me, that people would tell me. Mel would tell me an anecdote, and someone else would then throw in something about somebody that got cured of something. It's astounding how many interesting, strange things happen on this movie. So I think that when the book is written, those will all be talked about. And by the way, Jim wasn't the only person that got hit by lightning.
Oh.
Another guy got hit twice and survived, and there's no reason he should have survived. And then, as Mel tells it, we come to find out, you know, they're all looking at this kid from, I guess he lives in Italy, and they're just in awe, like, how, he gets hit once and then shouldn't have survived, then gets hit a couple weeks later and shouldn't have survived, but he was fine, sort of dusted himself off and he was fine. We come to find out that this was one of the few people that was ever baptized by the Pope himself. So I don't know, you know, call us crazy, there you go. I don't know, it's very interesting.
Well, obviously this has been a very moving and spiritual experience for you.
Yeah.
What would be the one thing that you would you'd take away from the film, that or just name one of the things that you'd take away from this film that you wouldn't have taken away from, let's say, a comedy or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. First and foremost, what it did for me, it completely strengthened my faith and reaffirmed my faith, my personal faith, and there's no doubt about that. That is the biggest byproduct for me, is that it was very physically related to me, or shown to me, Rob, that what the power of prayer is about. You know, the fact that I'm on this job and I made it to the finish line and I was lucky enough to be a part of it, you know, I cannot stress to you how seriously and how highly I should not have done this movie. There was no reason for me to do this movie. I tell people, if you looked at a list of 20 to 30 composers here in L.A. who are incredible composers, I probably wouldn't be on that list even for people considered for the movie. So, you know, I would throw it back to you or your listeners or anyone that I would speak to. Why in the world am I on this movie? I told Mel when he called me a couple weeks ago, and when he was so kind to call and just thank me again for the work. And I told him in all candor, I said, Mel, you know, I'm going to write you a letter to express to you my thanks and my chagrin at even being a part of it. But I said, you know, since I have you on the phone, I'll tell you this. I don't even know why the heck you hired me. But thank you, you know. And he laughed, and he goes, well, he goes, obviously, he's just such a well-spoken guy and doesn't wear his emotions on his sleeve perhaps as I do. Mm-hmm. But he's a very, very thoughtful guy. And he said, well, you know, it wasn't my choice alone, or something to that effect, and we laughed about it. But maybe that's it. I'm one of the few that I think you'll talk to, Rob, that that really shouldn't have been on this movie in the first place. So maybe I have a unique perspective in that regard. It's complete kismet that it just fell in my lap. And through all the other controversial music things that occurred, and you mentioned earlier, yes, there were other people that were involved musically, mm-hmm. that were talked about. Well, I went through all that. I survived all that, and I always felt that what was meant to be was meant to be. And, you know, I just stuck with it and knew that the one thing I couldn't do was leave the project, although there were days I wanted to. There were many days I wanted to, but I figured, you know what? If I leave the project, then someone else wins, and I don't want that someone else to win. And someone else isn't a human being, by the way.
Right.
So that's the way I looked at the whole thing, you know. And God, thank you, God, I made it. And so it was through a lot of help, divine and physical, mm-hmm. that I made it through.
Well, the results are incredible. Well, thank you very much for the time that you've given to me today. I can definitely tell your passion in your
thank
work.
Thank you.
It definitely comes through.
Good. It's a delight to talk to you, just to be able to field some great questions and also just talk about the film. I just hope everybody, gets something out of the film, and that I tell people another byproduct, as we spoke about earlier, that I hope for is a dialogue. I hope that even people that are not believers or whatever their belief is, that if they can just open up enough to go see the movie, and then we talk about it, and they may not believe in the movie, or they may not believe as a Christian would, but I'm hoping that a Buddhist or a Jewish person, I think there's going to be some wonderful, hopefully wonderful dialogues that we'll have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll be a wonderful, hopefully good, positive byproduct of the film.
Great. Well, like I said, thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's my interview with John Debney from 2004. Quite a while ago, but the meaning is clear that this changed his life, and or at least reaffirmed his faith in a lot of cases. So yeah, we're now at the point of the show where we're going to be talking about the Passion of the Christ. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, but we'll just discuss this briefly now. Joe, we've recently screened the Passion of the Christ at the church, and it is quite a brutal account of the last 12 hours of Christ's life. So how is it that how did you feel about the film itself as a depiction of those last few hours?
I felt that it was a realistic account of what I had known from my research about how the Romans, for example, used the scourging. I think that is the scene which is the most violent.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is based in reality because the Romans did develop implements like this and use them against opponents for reasons, I guess, perhaps to keep the others into line or so on. They were truly horrifying. Crucifixion is also an example of something that the Romans did as a warning to the rest. Now, it is, of course, also an artistic depiction, because you can mm-hmm. see how Mel Gibson draws upon classical paintings and so on, and you see them framed in the spots in the movie. So it isn't meant entirely to be like a true-to-life historical reconstruction in
right.
every respect,
mm-hmm.
but it does include things that we often ignore. I mean, our crucifixes that we see are very clean, they're very pretty, they're pristine in their shape and all that. Whereas the real crucifixion would have been a very pitiful-looking, ugly thing. And so some of that comes across in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good medicine for us, because Mel Gibson also communicates this. This is the intention of his film, is to say, look, this was the price that was paid for our sins. But he also shows how this was successful, and that at the end of the movie, Satan is chained and is basically confined to hell or to this abyss that we see
right.
him stuck in at the very end of the film. And Jesus then consequently gets up in his tomb and walks away.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick hint to the resurrection, which we will be celebrating this coming Sunday.
Exactly. Now, one of the scenes for me is right near the end, where you actually you see Jesus standing in the tomb, and you see it's shot through his... through the hands, and you see the holes in his hands.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was just like, wow, you don't see that
right.
very often.
Right. So, there's a reference to that in the Bible when Jesus appears to his disciples after he has risen from the dead. And unbelieving Thomas had said earlier, unless I feel the holes in his hands and the hole in his side with my own hands, I touch them, I will never believe. And Jesus appears to him and shows him these things. And this is when he says, my Lord and my God. This is the clearest reference in the New Testament to Jesus actually being deity.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is some incredible music for this incredible movie. So we're just gonna get to it, and then we'll be back to wrap up the show in just a little bit. So here is John Debney's music from The Passion of the Christ from 2004. We'll be back to wrap up things in just a bit. And with a little bit of music from The Passion of the Christ, it's music by John Debney. Well, that's all for us this week. Thanks for hanging in with us. And thank you, Joe, for coming in and providing your insight into the end of the show. So what have you got coming up in the next little while?
First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. We have the Easter season coming up, so our Easter celebration will be on Sunday morning, 9:15 and 11 o'clock. And we will be having, of course, our usual Sunday services at those times. You can visit our website at www.bethelkitchener.ca. Also, I'd like to just make a brief comment that even though all of these films, of course, give us differing portraits of Jesus and his work and his life, the best source is still the Bible itself. In various versions, our particular church likes to use ESV, as is our custom. And you can find that online and browse it yourself. Numerous versions are available online.
Great. All right. Well, like I said, that's all for us this week. Join me next week for Animated Oddities. And until then, we end off the show with some more music from The Passion of the Christ. God bless, and we'll be back, or I'll be back next week with more Visions and Sound.